on about 350 kids and their parents or foster parents to establish that this one diagnosis, developmental trauma disorder, captured the full range of what was wrong with these children. It would enable us to give them a single diagnosis, as opposed to multiple labels, and would firmly locate the origin of their problems in a combination of trauma and compromised attachment. In February 2009, we submitted our proposed new diagnosis of developmental trauma disorder to the American Psychiatric Association, stating the following in a cover letter. Children who develop in the context of ongoing danger, maltreatment, and disrupted caregiving systems are being ill-served by the current diagnostic systems that lead to an emphasis on behavioral control with no recognition of interpersonal trauma. Studies on the sequelae of childhood trauma in the context of caregiver abuse or neglect consistently demonstrate chronic and severe problems with emotion regulation, impulse control, attention and cognition, dissociation, interpersonal relationships, and self and relational schemas. In absence of a sensitive trauma-specific diagnosis, such children are currently diagnosed with an average of 3 to 8 comorbid disorders. The continued practice of applying multiple distinct comorbid diagnoses to traumatized children has grave consequences. It defies parsimony, obscures etiological clarity, and runs the danger of relegating treatment and intervention to a small aspect of the child's psychopathology, rather than promoting a comprehensive treatment approach. Shortly after submitting our proposal, I gave a talk on developmental trauma disorder in Washington, D.C., to a meeting of the mental health commissioners from across the country. They offered to support our initiative by writing a letter to the APA. The letter began by pointing out that the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors served 6.1 million people annually, with a budget of $29.5 billion, and concluded, "We urge the APA to add developmental trauma to its list of priority areas to clarify and better characterize its course and clinical sequelae, and to emphasize the strong need to address developmental trauma in the assessment of patients." I felt confident that this letter would ensure that the APA would take our proposal seriously. But several months after our submission, Matthew Friedman, executive director of the National Center for PTSD and chair of the relevant DSM subcommittee, informed us that DTD was unlikely to be included in the DSM-5. The consensus, he wrote, was that no new diagnosis was required to fill a missing diagnostic niche. 1 million children who are abused and neglected every year in the United States, a diagnostic niche? The letter went on, "The notion that early childhood adverse experiences lead to substantial developmental disruptions is more clinical intuition than a research-based fact. This statement is commonly made but cannot be backed up by prospective studies." In fact, we had included several prospective studies in our proposal. Let's look at just two of them here. How relationships shape development. Beginning in 1975 and continuing for almost 30 years, Alan Sroff and his colleagues tracked 180 children and their families to the Minnesota Longitudinal Study of Risk and Adaptation. At the time the study began, there was an intense debate about the role of nature versus nurture and temperament versus environment and human development, and this study set out to answer those questions. Trauma was not yet a popular topic, and child abuse and neglect were not a central focus of this study, at least initially, until they emerged as the most important predictors of adult functioning. Working with local medical and social agencies, the researchers recruited first-time Caucasian mothers who were poor enough to qualify for public assistance, but who had different backgrounds and different kinds and levels of support available for parenting. The study began 3 months before the children were born and followed the children for 30 years into adulthood, assessing and, where relevant, measuring all the major aspects of their functioning and all the significant circumstances of their lives. It considered several fundamental questions. How did children learn to pay attention while regulating their arousal, that is, avoiding extreme highs or lows, and keeping their impulses under control. What kinds of supports do they need, and when are these needed? After extensive interviews and testing of the prospective parents, the study really got off the ground in the newborn nursery, where researchers observed the newborns and interviewed the nurses caring for them. They then made home visits 7 and 10 days after birth. Before the children entered first grade, they and their parents were carefully assessed, a total of 15 times. After that, the children were interviewed and tested at regular intervals until age 28, with continuing input from mothers and teachers. Shroff and his colleagues found that quality of care and biological factors were closely interwoven. It is fascinating to see how the Minnesota results echo, though with far greater complexity, what Stephen Somi found in his primate laboratory. Nothing was written in stone. Neither the mother's personality, nor the infant's neurological anomalies at birth, nor its IQ, nor its temperament, including its activity level and reactivity to stress, predicted whether a child would develop serious behavioral problems in adolescence. The key issue, rather, was the nature of the parent-child relationship, how parents felt about and interacted with their kids. As with Somi's monkeys, the combination of vulnerable infants and inflexible caregivers made for clingy, uptight kids. Insensitive, pushy, and intrusive behavior on the part of the parents at 6 months predicted hyperactivity and attention problems in kindergarten and beyond. Focusing on many facets of development, particularly relationships with caregivers, teachers, and peers, Shroff and his colleagues found that caregivers not only help keep arousal within manageable bounds, but also help infants develop their own ability to regulate their arousal. Children who are regularly pushed over the edge into over-arousal and disorganization did not develop proper attunement of their inhibitory and excitatory brain systems, and grew up expecting that they would lose control if something upsetting happened. This was a vulnerable population, and by late adolescence, half of them had diagnosable mental health problems. There were clear patterns. The children who received consistent caregiving became well-regulated kids, while erratic caregiving produced kids who were chronically, physiologically aroused. The children of unpredictable parents often clamored for attention and became intensely frustrated in the face of small challenges. Their persistent arousal made them chronically anxious. Constantly looking for reassurance got in the way of playing and exploration, and as a result, they grew up chronically nervous and non-adventurous. Early parental neglect or harsh treatment led to behavior problems in school and predicted troubles with peers and a lack of empathy for the distress of others. This set up a vicious cycle. Their chronic arousal, coupled with lack of parental comfort, made them disruptive, oppositional, and aggressive. Disruptive and aggressive kids are unpopular and provoke further rejection and punishment, not only from their caregivers, but also from their teachers and peers. Shroff also learned a great deal about resilience, the capacity to bounce back from adversity. By far the most important predictor of how well his subjects cope with life's inevitable disappointments was the level of security established with their primary caregiver during the first 2 years of life. Shroff informally told me that he thought that resilience in adulthood could be predicted by how lovable mothers rated their kids at age 2. The long-term effects of incest. In 1986, Frank Putnam and Penelope Trickett, his colleague at the National Institute of Mental Health, initiated the first longitudinal study of the impact of sexual abuse on female development. Until the results of this study came out, our knowledge about the effects of incest was based entirely on reports from children who had recently disclosed their abuse and on accounts from adults reconstructing years or even decades later how incest had affected them. No study had ever followed girls as they matured to examine how sexual abuse might influence their school performance, peer relationships, and self-concept, as well as their later dating life. Putnam and Trickett also looked at changes over time in their subjects' stress hormones, reproductive hormones, immune function, and other physiological measures. In addition, they explored potential protective factors, such as intelligence and support from family and peers. The researchers painstakingly recruited 84 girls referred by the District of Columbia Department of Social Services, who had a confirmed history of sexual abuse by a family member. These were matched with a comparison group of 82 girls of the same age, race, socioeconomic status, and family constellation who had not been abused. The average starting age was 11. Over the next 20 years, these two groups were thoroughly assessed 6 times, once a year for the first 3 years, and again at ages 18, 19, and 25. Their mothers participated in the early assessments, and their own children took part in the last. A remarkable 96% of the girls, now grown women, have stayed in the study from its inception. The results are unambiguous. Compared with girls of the same age, race, and social circumstances, sexually abused girls suffer from a large range of profoundly negative effects, including cognitive deficits, depression, dissociative symptoms, troubled sexual development, high rates of obesity, and self-mutilation. They dropped out of high school at a higher rate than the control group and had more major illnesses and healthcare utilization. They also showed abnormalities in their stress hormone responses, had an earlier onset of puberty, and accumulated a host of different, seemingly unrelated psychiatric diagnoses. The follow-up research revealed many details of how abuse affects development. For example, each time they were assessed, the girls in both groups were asked to talk about the worst thing that had happened to them during the previous year. As they told their stories, the researchers observed how upset they became while measuring their physiology. During the first assessment, all the girls reacted by becoming distressed. 3 years later, in response to the same question, the non-abused girls once again displayed signs of distress, but the abused girls shut down and became numb. Their biology matched their observable reactions. During the first assessment, all of the girls showed an increase in the stress hormone cortisol. 3 years later, cortisol went down in the abused girls as they reported on the most stressful event of the past year. Over time, the body adjusts to chronic trauma. One of the consequences of numbing is that teachers, friends, and others are not likely to notice that a girl is upset. She may not even register it herself. By numbing out, she no longer reacts to distress the way she should, for example, by taking protective action. Putnam's study also captured the pervasive long-term effects of incest on friendships and partnering. Before the onset of puberty, non-abused girls usually have several girlfriends, as well as one boy who functions as a sort of spy, who informs them about what these strange creatures, boys, are all about. After they enter adolescence, their contacts with boys gradually increase. In contrast, before puberty, the abused girls rarely have close friends, girls or boys. But adolescence brings many chaotic and often traumatizing contacts with boys. Lacking friends in elementary school makes a crucial difference. Today, we're aware how cruel third, fourth, and fifth grade girls can be. It's a complex and rocky time when friends can suddenly turn on one another and alliances dissolve in exclusions and betrayals. But there is an upside. By the time girls get to middle school, most have begun to master a whole set of social skills, including being able to identify what they feel, negotiating relationships with others, pretending to like people they don't, and so on. And most of them have built a fairly steady support network of girls who become their stress debriefing team. As they slowly enter the world of sex and dating, these relationships give them room for reflection, gossip, and discussion of what it all means. The sexually abused girls have an entirely different developmental pathway. They don't have friends of either gender because they can't trust. They hate themselves and their biology is against them, leading them either to overreact or numb out. They can't keep up in the normal, envy-driven, inclusion-exclusion games, in which players have to stay cool under stress. Other kids usually don't want anything to do with them. They simply are too weird. But that's only the beginning of the trouble. The abused, isolated girls with incest histories mature sexually a year and a half earlier than the non-abused girls. Sexual abuse speeds up their biological clocks and the secretion of sex hormones. Early in puberty, the abused girls had 3 to 5 times the levels of testosterone and androstenedione, the hormones that fuel sexual desire, as the girls in the control group. Results of Putnam and Trickett's study continue to be published, but it has already created an invaluable roadmap for clinicians dealing with sexually abused girls. At the trauma center, for example, one of our clinicians reported on a Monday morning that a patient named Aisha had been raped again over the weekend. She had run away from her group home at 5 o'clock on Saturday, gone to a place in Boston where druggies hang out, smoked some dope, and done some other drugs, and then left with a bunch of boys in a car. At 5 o'clock Sunday morning, they had gang-raped her. Like so many of the adolescents we see, Aisha can't articulate what she wants or needs, and can't think through how she might protect herself. Instead, she lives in a world of actions. Trying to explain her behavior in terms of victim-perpetrator isn't helpful, nor are labels like depression, oppositional defiant disorder, intermittent explosive disorder, bipolar disorder, or any of the other options our diagnostic manuals offer us. Putnam's work has helped us understand how Aisha experiences the world. While she cannot tell us what is going on with her, why she is so impulsive and lacking in self-protection, and why she views us as frightening and intrusive, rather than as people who can help her. The DSM-5, a veritable smorgasbord of diagnoses. When DSM-5 was published in May 2013, it included some 300 disorders in its 945 pages. It offers a veritable smorgasbord of possible labels for the problems associated with severe early life trauma, including some new ones such as disruptive mood regulation disorder, non-suicidal self-injury, intermittent explosive disorder, dysregulated social engagement disorder, and disruptive impulse control disorder. Before the late 19th century, doctors classified illnesses according to their surface manifestations, like fevers and pustules, which was not unreasonable given that they had little else to go on. This changed when scientists like Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch discovered that many diseases were caused by bacteria that were invisible to the naked eye. Medicine then was transformed by its attempts to discover ways to get rid of those organisms, rather than just treating the boils and the fevers that they caused. With DSM-5, psychiatry firmly regressed to early 19th century medical practice. Despite the fact that we know the origin of many of the problems it identifies, its diagnoses describe surface phenomena that completely ignore the underlying causes. Even before DSM-5 was released, the American Journal of Psychiatry published the results of validity tests of various new diagnoses, which indicated that the DSM largely lacks what in the world of science is known as reliability, that is, the ability to produce consistent, replicable results. In other words, it lacks scientific validity. Oddly, the lack of reliability and validity did not keep the DSM-5 from meeting its deadline for publication, despite the near-universal consensus that it represented no improvement over the previous diagnostic system. Could the fact that the APA had earned $100 million on the DSM-4 and is slated to take in a similar amount with the DSM-5, because all mental health practitioners, many lawyers and other professionals will be obliged to purchase the latest edition, be the reason we have this new diagnostic system? Diagnostic reliability isn't an abstract issue. If doctors can't agree on what ails their patients, there is no way they can provide proper treatment. When there's no relationship between diagnosis and cure, a mislabeled patient is bound to be a mistreated patient. You would not want to have your appendix removed when you are suffering from a kidney stone. And you would not want to have somebody labeled as oppositional when, in fact, his behavior is rooted in an attempt to protect himself against real danger. In a statement released in June 2011, the British Psychological Society complained to the APA that the sources of psychological suffering in the DSM-5 were identified as located within individuals and overlooked the undeniable social causation of many such problems. This was in addition to a flood of protest from American professionals, including leaders of the American Psychological Association and the American Counseling Association. Why are relationships or social conditions left out? If you pay attention only to faulty biology and defective genes as the cause of mental problems and ignore abandonment, abuse, and deprivation, you are likely to run into as many dead ends as previous generations did, blaming it all on terrible mothers. The most stunning rejection of the DSM-5 came from the National Institute of Mental Health, which funds most psychiatric research in America. In April 2013, a few weeks before DSM-5 was formally released, NIMH Director Thomas Insel announced that his agency could no longer support DSM's symptom-based diagnosis. Instead, the Institute would focus its funding on what are called Research Domain Criteria, known as RDOC, to create a framework for studies that would cut across current diagnostic categories. For example, one of the NIMH domains is arousal modulator systems, meaning arousal, circadian rhythm, sleep, and wakefulness, which are disturbed to varying degrees in many patients. Like the DSM-5, the RDOC framework conceptualizes mental illnesses solely as brain disorders. This means that future research funding will explore the brain circuits and other neurobiological measures that underlie mental problems. Insel sees this as a first step toward the sort of precision medicine that has transformed cancer diagnosis and treatment. Mental illness, however, is not at all like cancer. Humans are social animals, and mental problems involve not being able to get along with other people, not fitting in, not belonging, and in general, not being able to get on the same wavelength. Everything about us, our brains, our minds, and our bodies, is geared toward collaboration in social systems. This is our most powerful survival strategy, the key to our success as a species, and it is precisely this that breaks down in most forms of mental suffering. As we saw in Part 2, the neural connections in brain and body are vitally important for understanding human suffering, but it is important not to ignore the foundations of our humanity. Relationships and interactions that shape our minds and brains when we are young and that give substance and meaning to our entire lives. People with histories of abuse, neglect, or severe deprivation will remain mysterious and largely untreated unless we heed the admonition of Alan Shrouf. To fully understand how we become the persons we are, the complex step-by-step evolution of our orientations, capacities, and behavior over time requires more than a list of ingredients, however important any one of them might be. It requires an understanding of the process of development, how all of these factors work together in an ongoing way over time. Frontline mental health workers, overwhelmed and underpaid social workers and therapists alike, seem to agree with our approach. Shortly after the APA rejected developmental trauma disorder for inclusion in the DSM, thousands of clinicians from around the country sent small contributions to the trauma center to help us conduct a large scientific study known as a field trial to further study DTD. That support has enabled us to interview hundreds of kids, parents, foster parents, and mental health workers at 5 different network sites over the last few years with scientifically constructed interview tools. The first results from these studies have now been published, and more will appear as this book is going to print. What difference would DTD make? One answer is that it would focus research and treatment, not to mention funding, on the central principles that underlie the protean symptoms of chronically traumatized children and adults: pervasive biological and emotional dysregulation, failed or disrupted attachment, problems staying focused and on track, and a hugely deficient sense of coherent personal identity and competence. These issues transcend and include almost all diagnostic categories. But treatment that doesn't put them front and center is more than likely to miss the mark. Our great challenge is to apply the lessons of neuroplasticity, the flexibility of brain circuits, to rewire the brains and reorganize the minds of people who have been programmed by life itself to experience others as threats and themselves as helpless. Social support is a biological necessity, not an option, and this reality should be the backbone of all prevention and treatment. Recognizing the profound effects of trauma and deprivation on child development need not lead to blaming parents. We can assume that parents do the best they can, but all parents need help to nurture their kids. Nearly every industrialized nation, with the exception of the United States, recognizes this and provides some form of guaranteed support to families. James Heckman, winner of the 2000 Nobel Prize in Economics, has shown that quality early childhood programs that involve parents and promote basic skills in disadvantaged children more than pay for themselves in improved outcomes. In the early 1970s, psychologist David Olds was working in a Baltimore daycare center where many of the preschoolers came from homes racked by poverty, domestic violence, and drug abuse. Aware that only addressing the child's problems at school was not sufficient to improve their home conditions, he started a home visitation program in which skilled nurses helped mothers to provide a safe and stimulating environment for their children and, in the process, to imagine a better future for themselves. 20 years later, the children of the home visitation mothers were not only healthier, but also less likely to report having been abused or neglected than a similar group whose mothers had not been visited. They also were more likely to have finished school, to have stayed out of jail, and to be working in well-paying jobs. Economists have calculated that every dollar invested in high-quality home visitation, daycare, and preschool programs results in $7 of savings on welfare payments, healthcare costs, substance abuse treatment, and incarceration, plus higher tax revenues due to better-paying jobs. When I go to Europe to teach, I often am contacted by officials at the ministries of health in the Scandinavian countries, the United Kingdom, Germany, or the Netherlands, and asked to spend an afternoon with them sharing the latest research on the treatment of traumatized children, adolescents, and their families. The same is true for many of my colleagues. These countries have already made a commitment to universal health care, ensuring a guaranteed minimum wage, paid parental leave for both parents after a child is born, and high-quality child care for all working mothers. Could this approach to public health have something to do with the fact that the incarceration rate in Norway is 71 per 100,000, in the Netherlands, 81 per 100,000, and the U.S., 781 per 100,000, while the crime rate in those countries is much lower than ours, and the cost of medical care about half? 70% of prisoners in California spent time in foster care while growing up. The United States spends $84 billion per year to incarcerate people at approximately $44,000 per prisoner. The Northern European countries, a fraction of that amount. Instead, they invest in helping parents to raise their children in safe and predictable surroundings. Their academic test scores and crime rates seem to reflect the success of those investments. Part 4. The Imprint of Trauma. Chapter 11 Uncovering Secrets The Problem of Traumatic Memory. It is a strange thing that all the memories have these two qualities. They are always full of quietness. That is the most striking thing about them. And even when things weren't like that in reality, they still seem to have that quality. They are soundless apparitions, which speak to me by looks and gestures, wordless and silent, and their silence is precisely what disturbs me. Erich Maria Remarque, from All Quiet on the Western Front. In the spring of 2002, I was asked to examine a young man who claimed to have been sexually abused while growing up by Paul Shanley, a Catholic priest who had served in his parish in Newton, Massachusetts. Now 25 years old, he had apparently forgotten the abuse until he heard that the priest was currently under investigation for molesting young boys. The question posed to me was, even though he had seemingly repressed the abuse for well over a decade after it ended, were his memories credible, and was I prepared to testify to that fact before a judge? I will share what this man, whom I'll call Julian, told me, drawing on my original case notes. Even though his real name is in the public record, I'm using a pseudonym because I hope that he has regained some privacy and peace with the passage of time. His experiences illustrate the complexities of traumatic memory. The controversies over the case against Father Shanley are also typical of the passions that have swirled around this issue, since psychiatrists first described the unusual nature of traumatic memories in the final decades of the 19th century. Flooded by sensations and images. On February 11, 2001, Julian was serving as a military policeman at an Air Force base. During his daily phone conversation with his girlfriend, Rachel, she mentioned a lead article she'd read that morning in the Boston Globe. A priest, named Shanley, was under suspicion for molesting children. Hadn't Julian once told her about a Father Shanley who had been his parish priest back in Newton? "Did he ever do anything to you?" she asked. Julian initially recalled Father Shanley as a kind man who had been very supportive after his parents got divorced. But as the conversation went on, he started to go into a panic. He suddenly saw Shanley silhouetted in a doorframe, his hands stretched out at 45 degrees, staring at Julian as he urinated. Overwhelmed by emotion, he told Rachel, "I've got to go." He called his flight chief, who came over, accompanied by the first sergeant. After he met with the two of them, they took him to the base chaplain. Julian recalls telling him, "Do you know what is going on in Boston? It happened to me, too." The moment he heard himself say those words, he knew for certain that Shanley had molested him, even though he did not remember the details. Julian felt extremely embarrassed about being so emotional. He had always been a strong kid who kept things to himself. That night he sat on the corner of his bed, hunched over, thinking he was losing his mind, and terrified that he would be locked up. Over the subsequent week, images kept flooding into his mind, and he was afraid of breaking down completely. He thought about taking a knife and plunging it into his leg just to stop the mental pictures. Then the panic attack started to be accompanied by seizures, which he called epileptic fits. He scratched his body until he bled. He constantly felt hot, sweaty, and agitated. Between panic attacks, he felt like a zombie. He observed himself from a distance, as if what he was experiencing were actually happening to somebody else. In April, he received an administrative discharge, just 10 days short of being eligible to receive full benefits. When Julian entered my office almost a year later, I saw a handsome, muscular guy who looked depressed and defeated. He told me immediately that he felt terrible about having left the Air Force. He wanted to make it his career, and he'd always received excellent evaluations. He loved the challenges and the teamwork, and he missed the structure of the military lifestyle. Julian was born in a Boston suburb, the second oldest of five children. His father left the family when Julian was about six because he could not tolerate living with Julian's emotionally labile mother. Julian and his father get along quite well, but he sometimes reproaches his father for having worked too hard to support his family and for abandoning him to the care of his unbalanced mother. Neither his parents nor any of his siblings has ever received psychiatric care or been involved with drugs. Julian was a popular athlete in high school. Although he had many friends, he felt pretty bad about himself and covered up for being a poor student by drinking and partying. He feels ashamed that he took advantage of his popularity and good looks by having sex with many girls. He mentioned wanting to call several of them to apologize for how badly he treated them. He remembered always hating his body. In high school, he took steroids to pump himself up and smoked marijuana almost every day. He didn't go to college, and after graduating from high school, he was virtually homeless for almost a year because he could no longer stand living with his mother. He enlisted to try to get his life back on track. Julian met Father Shanley at age 6 when he was taking a CCD catechism class at the parish church. He remembered Father Shanley taking him out of the class for confession. Father Shanley rarely wore a cassock, and Julian remembered the priest's dark blue corduroy pants. They would go to a big room with one chair facing another and a bench to kneel on. The chairs were covered with red, and there was a red velvet cushion on the bench. They played cards, a game of war that turned into strip poker. Then he remembered standing in front of a mirror in that room. Father Shanley made him bend over. He remembered Father Shanley putting a finger into his anus. He does not think Shanley ever penetrated him with his penis, but he believes that the priest fingered him on numerous occasions. Other than that, his memories were quite incoherent and fragmentary. He had flashes of images of Shanley's face, and of isolated incidents. Shanley standing in the door of the bathroom, the priest going down on his knees and moving it around with his tongue. He could not say how old he was when that happened. He remembered the priest telling him how to perform oral sex, but he did not remember actually doing it. He remembered passing out pamphlets in church and then Father Shanley sitting next to him in a pew, fondling him with one hand and holding Julian's hand on himself with the other. He remembered that, as he grew older, Father Shanley would pass close to him and caress his penis. Paul did not like it, but did not know what to do to stop it. After all, he told me, Father Shanley was the closest thing to God in my neighborhood. In addition to these memory fragments, traces of his sexual abuse were clearly being activated and replayed. Sometimes, when he was having sex with his girlfriend, the priest's image popped into his head and, as he said, he would lose it. A week before I interviewed him, his girlfriend had pushed a finger into his mouth and playfully said, "You give good head." Julian jumped up and screamed, "If you ever say that again, I'll fucking kill you." Then, terrified, they both started to cry. This was followed by one of Julian's epileptic fits in which he curled up in a fetal position, shaking and whimpering like a baby. While telling me this, Julian looked very small and very frightened. Julian alternated between feeling sorry for the old man that Father Shanley had become and simply wanting to take him into a room somewhere and kill him. He also spoke repeatedly of how ashamed he felt, how hard it was to admit that he could not protect himself. "Nobody fucks with me, and now I have to tell you this." His image was of a big, tough Julian. How do we make sense of a story like Julian's? Years of apparent forgetting, followed by fragmented, disturbing images, dramatic physical symptoms, and sudden reenactments? As a therapist treating people with a legacy of trauma, my primary concern is not to determine exactly what happened to them, but to help them tolerate the sensations and emotions and reactions they experience without being constantly hijacked by them. When the subject of blame arises, the central issue that needs to be addressed is usually self-blame, accepting that the trauma was not their fault, that it was not caused by some defect in themselves, and that no one could ever have deserved what happened to them. Once a legal case is involved, however, determination of culpability becomes primary, and with it the admissibility of evidence. I had previously examined 12 people who had been sadistically abused as children in the Catholic orphanage in Burlington, Vermont. They had come forward, with many other claimants, more than 4 decades later, and although none had had any contact with the others until the first claim was filed, their abuse memories were astonishingly similar. They all named the same names, and the particular abuses that each nun or priest had committed, in the same rooms, with the same furniture, and as part of the same daily routines. Most of them subsequently accepted an out-of-court settlement from the Vermont diocese. Before a case goes to trial, the judge holds a so-called Daubert hearing to set the standards for expert testimony to be presented to the jury. In a 1996 case, I had convinced a federal circuit court judge in Boston that it was common for traumatized people to lose all memories of the event in question, only to regain access to them in bits and pieces at a much later date. The same standards would apply in Julian's case. While my report to his lawyer remains confidential, it was based on decades of clinical experience and research on traumatic memory, including the work of some of the great pioneers of modern psychiatry. Normal versus traumatic memory. We all know how fickle memory is. Our stories change and are constantly revised and updated. When my brothers, sisters, and I talk about events in our childhood, we always end up feeling that we grew up in different families. So many of our memories simply do not match. Such autobiographical memories are not precise reflections of reality. They are stories we tell to convey our personal take on our experience. The extraordinary capacity of the human mind to rewrite memory is illustrated in the Grant Study of Adult Development, which has systematically followed the psychological and physical health of more than 200 Harvard men from their sophomore years of 1939 to 1944 to the present. Of course, the designers of the study could not have anticipated that most of the participants would go off to fight in World War II, but we can now track the evolution of their wartime memories. The men were interviewed in detail about their war experiences in 1945-46 and again in 1989-1990. 4.5 decades later, the majority gave very different accounts from the narratives recorded in their immediate post-war interviews. With the passage of time, events had been bleached of their intense horror. In contrast, those who had been traumatized and subsequently developed PTSD did not modify their accounts. Their memories were preserved essentially intact 45 years after the war ended. Whether we remember a particular event at all, and how accurate our memories of it are, largely depends on how personally meaningful it was, and how emotional we felt about it at the time. The key factor is our level of arousal. We all have memories associated with particular people, songs, smells, and places that stay with us for a long time. Most of us still have precise memories of where we were and what we saw on Tuesday, September 11, 2001, but only a fraction of us recall anything in particular about September 10th. Most day-to-day experience passes immediately into oblivion. On ordinary days, we don't have much to report when we come home in the evening. The mind works according to schemes or maps, and incidents that fall outside the established pattern are most likely to capture our attention. If we get a raise or a friend tells us some exciting news, we will retain the details of the moment, at least for a while. We remember insults and injuries best. The adrenaline that we secrete to defend against potential threats helps to engrave those incidents into our minds. Even if the content of the remark fades, our dislike for the person who made it usually persists. When something terrifying happens, like seeing a child or a friend get hurt in an accident, we will retain an intense and largely accurate memory of the event for a long time. As James McGaw and colleagues have shown, the more adrenaline you secrete, the more precise your memory will be. But that is true only up to a certain point. Confronted with horror, especially the horror of inescapable shock, this system becomes overwhelmed and breaks down. Of course, we can't monitor what happens during a traumatic experience, but we can reactivate the trauma in the laboratory, as was done for the brain scans in chapters 3 and 4. When memory traces of the original sounds, images, and sensations are reactivated, the frontal lobe shuts down, including, as we've seen, the region necessary to put feelings into words, the region that creates our sense of location and time, and the thalamus, which integrates the raw data of incoming sensations. At this point, the emotional brain, which is not under conscious control and cannot communicate in words, takes over. The emotional brain, that is the limbic area in the brainstem, expresses its altered activation through changes in emotional arousal, body physiology, and muscular action. Under ordinary conditions, these two memory systems, rational and emotional, collaborate to produce an integrated response. But high arousal not only changes the balance between them, but also disconnects other brain areas necessary for the proper storage and integration of incoming information, such as the hippocampus and the thalamus. As a result, the imprints of traumatic experiences are organized not as coherent logical narratives, but in fragmented sensory and emotional traces, images, sounds, and physical sensations. Julian saw a man with outstretched arms, a pew, a staircase, a strip poker game. He felt a sensation in his penis, a panicked sense of dread. But there was little or no story. Uncovering the Secrets of Trauma. In the late 19th century, when medicine first began the systematic study of mental problems, the nature of traumatic memory was one of the central topics under discussion. In France and England, a prodigious number of articles were published on a syndrome known as railway spine, a psychological aftermath of railroad accidents that included loss of memory. The greatest advances, however, came in the study of hysteria, a mental disorder characterized by emotional outbursts, susceptibility to suggestion, and contractions and paralyses of the muscles that could not be explained by simple anatomy. Once considered an affliction of unstable or malingering women, the name comes from the Greek word for womb, hysteria now became a window into the mysteries of mind and body. The names of some of the greatest pioneers in neurology and psychiatry, such as Jean-Martin Charcot, Pierre Janet, and Sigmund Freud, are associated with the discovery that trauma is at the root of hysteria, particularly the trauma of childhood sexual abuse. These early researchers referred to traumatic memories as pathogenic secrets or mental parasites, because as much as the sufferers wanted to forget whatever had happened, their memories kept forcing themselves into consciousness, trapping them in an ever-renewing present of existential horror. The interest in hysteria was particularly strong in France, and, as so often happens, its roots lay in the politics of the day. Jean-Martin Charcot, who was widely regarded as the father of neurology, and his pupils, such as Gilles de la Tourette, lent their names to numerous neurological diseases, was also active in politics. After Emperor Napoleon III abdicated in 1870, there was a struggle between the monarchists, the old order backed by the clergy, and the advocates of the fledgling French Republic, who believed in science and in secular democracy. Charcot believed that women would be a critical factor in this struggle, and his investigation of hysteria offered a scientific explanation for phenomena such as demonic possession states, witchcraft, exorcism, and religious ecstasy. Charcot conducted meticulous studies of the physiological and neurological correlates of hysteria in both men and women, all of which emphasized embodied memory and a lack of language. For example, in 1889, he published the case of a patient named Lelogue, who developed paralysis of the legs after being involved in a traffic accident with a horse-drawn cart. Although Lelogue fell to the ground and lost consciousness, his legs appeared unhurt, and there were no neurological signs that would indicate a physical cause for his paralysis. Charcot discovered that just before Lelog passed out, he saw the wheels of the cart approaching him and strongly believed he would be run over. He noted that the patient does not preserve any recollection. Questions addressed to him upon this point are attended with no result. He knows nothing, or almost nothing. Like many other patients at the Salpêtrière, Lelog expressed his experience physically. Instead of remembering the accident, he developed paralysis of his legs. But for me, the real hero of this story is Pierre Genet, who helped Charcot establish a research laboratory devoted to the study of hysteria at the Salpêtrière. In 1889, the same year that the Eiffel Tower was built, Genet published the first book-length scientific account of traumatic stress, L'automatisme psychologique. Genet proposed that at the root of what we now call PTSD was the experience of vehement emotions or intense emotional arousal. This treatise explained that, after having been traumatized, people automatically keep repeating certain actions, emotions, and sensations related to the trauma. And, unlike Charcot, who was primarily interested in measuring and documenting patients' physical symptoms, Genet spent untold hours talking with them, trying to discover what was going on in their minds. Also, in contrast to Charcot, whose research focused on understanding the phenomena of hysteria, Genet was first and foremost a clinician whose goal was to treat his patients. And that is why I studied his case reports in detail, and why he became one of my most important teachers. Amnesia, dissociation, and reenactment. Genet was the first to point out the difference between narrative memory, the stories people tell about trauma, and traumatic memory itself. One of his case histories was the story of Irène, a young woman who was hospitalized following her mother's death from tuberculosis. Irène had nursed her mother for many months while continuing to work outside the home to support her alcoholic father and pay for her mother's medical care. When her mother finally died, Irène, exhausted from stress and lack of sleep, tried for several hours to revive the corpse, calling out to her mother and trying to force medicine down her throat. At one point, the lifeless body dropped off the bed while Irène's drunken father lay passed out nearby. Even after her aunt arrived and started preparing for burial, Irène's denial persisted. She had to be persuaded to attend the funeral, and she laughed throughout the service. A few weeks later, she was brought to the Salpêtrière, where Genet took over her case. In addition to amnesia for her mother's death, Irène suffered from another symptom. Several times a week, she would stare, trance-like, at an empty bed, ignore whatever was going on around her, and began to care for an imaginary person. She meticulously reproduced, rather than remembered, the details of her mother's death. Traumatized people simultaneously remember too little and too much. On the one hand, Irène had no conscious memory of her mother's death. She could not tell the story of what had happened. On the other, she was compelled to physically act out the events of her mother's death. Genet's term, automatism, conveys the involuntary, unconscious nature of her actions. Genet treated Irène for several months, mainly with hypnosis. At the end, he asked her again about her mother's death. Irène started to cry and said, "Don't remind me of those terrible things. My mother was dead and my father was a complete drunk, as always. I had to take care of her dead body all night long. I did a lot of silly things in order to revive her. In the morning, I lost my mind." Not only was Irène able to tell the story, but she had also recovered her emotions. "I feel very sad and abandoned." Genet now called her memory complete because it now was accompanied by the appropriate feelings. Genet noted significant differences between ordinary and traumatic memory. Traumatic memories are precipitated by specific triggers. In Julian's case, the trigger was his girlfriend's seductive comments. In Irène's, it was a bed. When one element of a traumatic experience is triggered, other elements are likely to automatically follow. Traumatic memory is not condensed. It took Irène 3 to 4 hours to reenact her story. But when she was finally able to tell what had happened, it took less than a minute. The traumatic enactment serves no function. In contrast, ordinary memory is adaptive. Our stories are flexible and can be modified to fit the circumstances. Ordinary memory is essentially social. It's a story that we tell for a purpose. In Irene's case, to enlist her doctor's help and comfort. In Julian's case, to recruit me to join his search for justice and revenge. But there is nothing social about traumatic memory. Julian's rage at his girlfriend's remark serves no useful purpose. Reenactments are frozen in time, unchanging, and they are always lonely, humiliating, and alienating experiences. Genet coined the term dissociation to describe the splitting off and isolation of memory imprints that he saw in his patients. He was also prescient about the heavy cost of keeping these traumatic memories at bay. He later wrote that when patients dissociate their traumatic experience, they become attached to an insurmountable obstacle. Unable to integrate their traumatic memories, they seem to lose their capacity to assimilate new experiences as well. It is as if their personality has definitely stopped at a certain point and cannot enlarge anymore by the addition or assimilation of new elements. He predicted that unless they become aware of the split-off elements and integrated them into a story that had happened in the past but was now over, they would experience a slow decline in their personal and professional functioning. This phenomenon has now been well documented in contemporary research. Genet discovered that while it is normal to change and distort one's memories, people with PTSD are unable to put the actual event, the source of those memories, behind them. Dissociation prevents the trauma from becoming integrated within the conglomerated, ever-shifting stories of autobiographical memory, in essence creating a dual memory system. Normal memory integrates the elements of each experience into the continuous flow of self-experience by a complex process of association. Think of a dense but flexible network where each element exerts a subtle influence on many others. But in Julian's case, the sensations, thoughts, and emotions of the trauma were stored separately as frozen, barely comprehensible fragments. If the problem with PTSD is dissociation, the goal of treatment would be association, integrating the cut-off elements of the trauma into the ongoing narrative of life, so that the brain can recognize that that was then and this is now. The Origins of the Talking Cure. Psychoanalysis was born on the wards of the Salpêtrière. In 1885, Freud went to Paris to work with Charcot, and he later named his firstborn son, Jean Martin, in Charcot's honor. In 1893, Freud and his Viennese mentor, Joseph Breuer, cited both Charcot and Genet in a brilliant paper on the cause of hysteria. "Hysterics suffer mainly from reminiscences," they proclaimed, and go on to note that these memories are not subject to the wearing away process of normal memories, but persist for a long time with astonishing freshness. Nor can traumatized people control when they will emerge. They wrote, "We must mention another remarkable fact, namely, that these memories, unlike other memories of their past lives, are not at the patient's disposal. On the contrary, these experiences are completely absent from the patient's memory when they are in a normal, psychical state, and are only present in a highly summary form." Breuer and Freud believed that traumatic memories were lost to ordinary consciousness, either because circumstances made a reaction impossible, or because they started during severely paralyzing effects such as fright. In 1896, Freud boldly claimed that the ultimate cause of hysteria is always the seduction of the child by an adult. Then, faced with his own evidence of an epidemic of abuse in the best families of Vienna, one, he noted, that would implicate his own father, he quickly began to retreat. Psychoanalysis shifted to an emphasis on unconscious wishes and fantasies, though Freud occasionally kept acknowledging the reality of sexual abuse. After the horrors of World War I confronted him with the reality of combat neuroses, Freud reaffirmed that lack of verbal memory is central in trauma, and that if a person does not remember, he is likely to act out. He wrote, He reproduces it not as a memory, but as an action,